Well, that was Mr. Pharmacist by The Fall. Welcoming to the show, Stuart Lee, officially.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yeah. Oh, nice to have you on. Now you're officially the 41st best.
Yeah, well, I think I've been promoted now.
Oh, right, I was going to ask, have you slipped or have you gained
places? Well, there was after I was the 41st best on the spurious Channel 4 poll, I did a telly show and more people saw me, and as a result of that, I went up, which it would have been bad to go down as if exposure. I went up to 12, which is even more stupid than being 41st best. I mean, I could think of dozens of comedians now that are better than me. But anyway, yeah, I'm now the 12th best, but I don't think I could have... I did a show called 41st Best Stand-Up Ever, because 41 seems just about right to be a mixture of arrogant and humble. But if you actually went around saying, I'm the 12th best comedian ever, I think people would go, all right, come on.
Yeah.
But 41st seems sort
look
of,
at you, know, yeah.
Yeah.
I just heard The Fall there as well, and you've got a new book here called How I Escaped My Certain Fate, or The Life and Deaths of a Stand-Up Comedian. And you open the book up with the line, I never wanted to be a comedian.
Yeah.
But that changed at a Fall gig.
At a Fall gig, yeah. I saw it was in, I'd seen comedy, obviously, as a kid, and there were, you know, I'd seen stand-ups. I'd even seen some of what was then the early 80s alternative comics live. I'd seen Phil Jupitus when he used to be a funny poet, and one of the guys from the comic strip opening for Dexys. But I still didn't think, and I really like comedy and I really like writing, but I didn't think it was something I could do, because I thought you had to be a performer, you know. And then I saw this guy opening for The Fall, Ted Chippington, who's what you would now call anti-comedy, but at the time just seemed like a man with no real material. He wasn't, he didn't care whether anyone liked him or not.
Right,
and
right.
And it was, you know, you read these books about people, think, oh, I saw the Sex Pistols in Manchester in 1976 and I thought I could do that and it changed my life. Or, you know, Billy Bragg saying, oh, I saw the Clash, and all those people of that generation talking about being inspired by punk bands. And I had that kind of moment seeing Ted Chippington, where I thought, wow, you know, I thought you had to kind of laugh and look happy and run around, but it seems you can just stand there looking at the floor and scowling.
But you took none of that on yourself, obviously.
Like, yeah. It doesn't matter if half the room don't like it, you know. So, I mean, it was really inspiring. And I met him a couple of years ago, and I don't think he really likes me or what I do.
It's the same with me with The Fall, actually, right. But that's another story.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it was seeing Ted Chippington open for The Fall.
Do you think there are parallels in the way that we choose the music that we like and the comedy that we like as well? Do you think it expresses something about ourselves?
Well, I'm not sure that there used to be, because I don't think that enough people knew enough about stand-up, for example, to wear it like a badge of honour. You know, like when I was a kid, people would be walking around the shopping centre on Saturday afternoon holding their albums under their arms, decide what they were like.
Yeah.
Well, it's more difficult to do that with comedy. But I do think that now there's such a massive smorgasbord of different stand-ups that are all easily available, I do think you get sort of types of people at things.
Yeah.
And our Al Murray pub landlord audience is really different to a Russell Howard audience, for example. Whereas before, you just used to go and see some stand-up. And, you know, it was all kind of the same sorts of, it was all different kinds of people, you know.
One of the reasons that I was thinking about that was, in your book, you talk a lot about how you reappraised your own career and where you were and how you wanted to go back to, like, when you started stand-up again, you wanted to come back almost as a reaction to the stadium gigs of the 90s and have what seemed to me almost like an indie label approach to your comedy.
Yeah, well, that's true, but you've made it sound a bit like it was an ethical decision, and it was largely financial. You know, it was sort of that. I think, you know, if you want to look at it in music terms, I was like a heritage artist, you know, like one of these people that hangs around on your record label, you know, if managed correctly, making you a bit of money a year until they die. But I was being managed in the era when comedy was a new rock and roll, in a kind of pop music way, you know, and sort of money was spent on you to get you to places. And then, like you get with a lot of bands, you then just ended up in debt or not really seeing any of it. And when I gave up and started again, I thought, I've got to really, really downsize and try and work out how to connect with the people that would actually like it. And I was thinking about musicians that I like The Fall, or like, you know, a lot of American sort of country rock guys, or the free jazz people that seem to manage to keep going despite not being in the charts. You know, there has to be if you can just trim everything off, you know, I could keep going. Because I also knew I could never, I'm not Mr. Saturday Night, you know, I couldn't do Jongleurs and the Comedy Store and corporate gigs. And again, it wasn't like, oh, I won't do those. It was just, I can't do them because I haven't got any jokes. You know, so I had to find an audience of people that would be prepared to not be entertained.
Do you feel you've found your audience now? Do you feel very comfortable with your audience?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I do on whole. About 1 in 20 times on tour, you know, you can sort of tell they'd have preferred something else, but you can normally get away with it. But I also think the thing that's totally changed, I stopped doing stand-up in 2000, I started again in 2004, and in that 4 years, there was YouTube, there was MySpace, all this stuff kind of happened that meant you could sort of hand-pick your audience. You could look at what they were into. And sort of, you know, you could leave information on websites that were appropriate, and it sort of totally changed everything. And all those, I think of all the bands that I liked as a kid that you used to have to really, you used to have to buy fanzines and ask in record shops, and it was like a Bush Telegraph to find them, and now... Sure, yeah. Everything's just, you can just get to it
instant,
immediately.
Instant, yeah.
And I think that's really helped me, because I think I'm a niche comedian, but I think that the internet means that you can just about find everyone that might like you, and then you might be able to get to get by, you know.
Do you see any negative sides to things like YouTube, for example? The reason I say this is because I saw you the other night, and a couple of seats along from me, there was a couple filming it on their phones.
Oh God, really?
Does that wind you up a bit?
Well,
because your material's out there before you.
That's
get to deliver
the
it to people.
Worry about that, right? Is that the little gigs you're doing at the moment? They're supposed to be where you're trying stuff out, you know. And obviously, you'd be more inhibited if you knew it was being filmed. Also, that's like the third time I've done that, and I'm trying to hang on to it to do it on telly in January, February. And if it's sort of out there, it sort of takes away the sting of it, you know. So I would have taken the phone off them and jumped up and down on it if I'd seen it. Oh, seriously. But on the other hand, you know, when the stuff you've filmed yourself gets sort of put up on YouTube, I mean, I know the guy that does my DVD, they sell five times less than the amount there, you know.
They're watched on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you look on those torrent sites, you know, you can find five times as many that have been downloaded. But then on the other hand, people watch it, they come and see you, and it just means it throws the emphasis of how you survive onto the live work. You know. But I mean, the really weird thing about all that, like people filming you and stuff, is as a sort of a barely recognisable F-list celebrity, you just feel a bit paranoid all the time. Like, I was doing a gig the other night, and I'd been awake. I had about 5 hours sleep in about 2 days with doing gigs and looking after my son. And I got in, and I sat on a sofa at the back of this little room while the first act was on, which was Andy Osho, who's a young comic, he's on Channel 4 now, and I fell asleep, right? And then as I woke up, there was a guy in front of me taking a photo of me asleep on his camera, right? And I thought, right, what's going to happen? This is going to be on the internet, isn't it? Stuart Lee asleep during Andy Osho's set.
Oh, no.
So I went, give us that, and I took his phone off him, and I sat down and tried to delete the photo, right? And then he went, oh, give me phone back. And I went, no, I'm just going to delete this. And then he threw a pint of beer over me and left.
Oh, wow.
And then his girlfriend left. And then she came back about 20 minutes later asking for his phone, which, again, I would have smashed to bits, except that there was loads of photos of little kids on it. I thought, that seems unfair. But it just makes you a bit on edge all the time you know, like about thinking you can't do anything. And Twitter, you know, like, I mean, you must get this much more. But if I look on Twitter, which I'm not a member of, it's basically about every 3 hours, someone says what I'm doing.
Oh, right. Like, yeah. I saw so-and-so. Yeah.
It's a bit like being a criminal that's been tagged.
You know, constantly under observation. Yeah.
Stuart Lee went in a cafe. I just served Stuart Lee a pint of whatever, and I saw Stuart Lee and his son picked up some milk and stuff. It's just like bizarre.
Enough to make you paranoid.
Yeah, enough to make you paranoid. What it means, you think you couldn't be spontaneously affectionate to anyone, and you couldn't lose your temper. You sort of like feel a bit on edge, because proper celebrities aren't in the cafe or on the train, are they? They're like, yeah. It's just the people you've barely heard of, but being
who live very ordinary lives, really, like between the
yeah.
And you're heading to the Fringe soon in Edinburgh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've done it every year except one since 1987. It's really, really great. I think it's the best thing in the year. I really look forward to it. And also I do a little room at the Stand and work out the new stuff for the tour and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm doing a show called vegetable stew, which is just a mess of different things at the stand every day in August.
I read recently something you wrote about the Fringe in general, about how you felt it's maybe changed a little bit since you were first there in the 80s.
Yeah, it has, but it's still amazing. I mean, what's great about it is that it's not curated by anyone, right? And people don't really understand that it's not like an arts festival that's funded by a city where the great and the good decide how to program it and what reflects where culture's at now. You just have to pay to get a room and a space and a listing, and then you're in. And what that means is that it actually reflects what artists or egomaniacs want to do. So you get this incredible mix of stuff. And people that would never get selected in theatre or musical comedy to represent a city's idea of culture often end up, you know, being the thing that really takes off. So yeah. It is great like that.
Are there any memories of recent years you can think of at the Fringe that surprised you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I was talking about one last night. I was talking to someone last night who was saying he would like to ask Nigel Kennedy if he would do, you know, improvised free jazz music with someone. And I went, ah. And I remembered a gig that was run in Edinburgh in the early 90s by some people that were something to do with the commune that the Butthole Surfers lived on in Texas. I think they were a little band called Green Jello or something. I can't remember. No, maybe not. Anyway, they had this room, and they used to do a show in this little room under the arches every night where this sort of band would play. Then a man would come out and he would eat a whole jar of mayonnaise and then vomit it into a sort of pattern of circles on the floor. And then a woman would come out and give a quite interesting lecture about weather systems. And this was the show, right? And then the second half was sort of whoever was in the room would kind of do something. Right. And one night I saw Nigel Kennedy playing the violin with John Maloney, who was a comic, playing the baran, the Irish drum, you know. Sure. And Will Gaines, who's like was about 80 then, who's like an old tap dancer from like the days when they do patter, you know, he do little bit of dancing and then, you know, so I found my friend in bed with my wife. I said, hey, I have to with you. And then like another bit, the three of them like doing stuff together and that, and Kennedy really improvising and Will Gaines being really funny and John Maloney doing traditional Irish percussion. And so it's that sort of thing, you know, that not necessarily even the stuff that's programmed, the stuff that just kind of happens by accident because you've got thousands of artists in a city and,
just the, you know, fluke of that collision of that personalities. Yeah.
And also that's something, you know, if you'd gone to someone and gone, could I have some money to put Nigel Kennedy together with a kind of pre-war American vaudeville entertainer and an Irish folk musician?
It might not have worked quite so well.
you wouldn't get it. You know,
so, no, definitely. I've got to ask you, this is on behalf of Bob, our bass player, to dispel an urban myth. And, we know you're a big music fan, but... is it true that you measure your music collection in length rather than numbers of CDs or records?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I've just been trying to do that. I can't tell you what it is at the moment because it's all... When our son was born, I put loads of stuff in storage, and now we're finally living somewhere. I'm just getting it all out. And I'm just trying to write a piece for The Observer, actually, about the idea of shelves. And when you're 43 and you're measuring your record collection in feet, and you're trying to put it on shelves, what's the actual point of that? Are you hoping that some like 51-year-old uncut reader is going to come round and go, oh, I see you've got the complete works of Steve Earle, well done. You know, what's the point of it? Are you trying to impress? You know, so I mean, I've been thinking about that a lot lately. Sort of, you know, to what extent is your actual home becoming enslaved by this idea of a monument to your own achievement of having listened to a lot of country rock albums or something, you know, it's sort of weird. But yeah, I did do that, and it's more difficult. That's the thing, you know, young people now, they just store it all, don't they? MP3s, they don't have this issue.
Yeah. Is there anything from your yards and yards of music you'd like to play us out with on the show today?
Well, because it's you, and you were on their label years back, maybe, and because I thought they were really funny, and because I expect it will be a challenge for you to find something that's broadcastable, something where the country teases.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much, Stuart Lee.